Anyway, as David just said, you know, last biology talk in this venue was asking whether biology is computable. Terry Hua in our program gave a talk titled How to Compute with Biology, or How Biology Computes. So I thought that I should ask a question of what's there to compute. But in reality, of course, I'm not so much interested in what there is to compute, but more broadly, what is there for a theorist to do in biology? And I'm not going to be very and I'm not going to be very philosophical about it. I'll just give a couple examples. Are we okay? So anyway, so having taken this very broad and general interpretation of computation, I'm going to take a very narrow view of biology. So I'm not going to talk about neuroscience, for example. And you know, there are a lot of so theory-friendly problems in neuroscience. I'm not going to talk about biophysics. And of course, there's a wealth of physics and theoretical physics problems in sort of more conventional biophysics, you know, having to do with sort of physical interactions between biomolecules. You know, for example, folding of RNA or packaging condensation of DNA into viral capsids. Now, good physics can be done there. So instead, I'm going to focus on so information and regulation, or so biological networks, which of course is the subject of our program. So you know, by now there are lots of genomes that are known. So there are genes, but in a way, what we want to know next are how these genes translate into functions. And we know that different cells under different conditions behave differently because they express different genes, which is to say they make different proteins. So they end up with a different portfolio of proteins and end up functioning differently. So there is regulation. And the third spoke is the external world, because in, or if you like, interactions between different cells, because it is this interaction with the environment which determines necessity for this or that function, and that provides an input to the regulatory system. So the kind of questions we want to understand is, for example, how a single cell coordinates its, or a single cell organism, like bacteria or yeast, coordinate its many functions and responds to its environment. Or we know that different cells in you know, complex multicellular organisms are different. You know, liver cell is different from the heart cell and from a neuron. And they became functionally and morphologically different early on in the development, again, by virtue of expressing different sets of proteins. I'm sorry, sets of genes and proteins. So the question is, how do cells coordinate their differentiation and development? So this problem of patterning and growth in development. And finally, it has been pointed out a long time ago that one can understand various things about biology and various things about particular mechanisms for this or that, but you can only make sense of that in the context of evolution. And our program had these evolutionary questions constantly in the background. But it is remarkable, actually, how little we know about it and how little was finally said. So there seems to be some sort of a hierarchy among these problems. So the behavior of single cells, development, and evolution. Understanding single cells promises most, where's Lewis? Most immediate gratification. But what we would really like to understand eventually is evolution. So let me, again, I'm just going to, there is no way in the world I can go into this in any depth. So I'm just going to throw a few examples at you.
Excuse me, is it a situation of different genes in different cells doing different things, or the same gene in different cells doing different things?
Well, simplistically, let's say different genes in under different conditions are being activated. Then, high eukaryotes, there is a very complicated and interesting and evolving story about sort of multiple splicing, where under different conditions or in different cell types, the same gene can produce not just one protein, but several different proteins, and it has to be regulated. But
I
just did.
But I think the question mark, all cells have the same genes in an organism, basically.
Right.
I'm sorry.
So, and good. Right. So where was I? Lewis, you want to do the rest? Okay. So anyway, so I'm going to start with an example of a single cell doing a non-trivial thing. So think of yeast. So yeast cell. Yeast is capable of rather interesting behavior. So for example, if you have yeast, happy yeast cell, which grows happily and meets a mate and meets a cell of an opposite sex, it will mate. So mating. But on the other hand, if you have a colony of yeast cells growing, fall onto hard times and nutritionally deprived. So here's, I'm changing magnification, right? So here's the colony of yeast cells starving. So they turn aggressive and change their mode of growth into filamentation. So filamentation. So this way they can invade the medium in which they're growing, and they hope to find better living. So
I think that's a picture of a bunch of cells.
Yeah. So this is the picture of a bunch of cells, so they don't sort of dissociate when they divide, but they stick together and form sort of filamentous tissue. Okay. So how does the cell decide what to do when? Well, mating starts with the detection of the pheromone molecule emitted by the opposite sex. And that binds to a specialized receptor, which gets activated, which is to say it becomes catalytically active. And it catalyzes transfer of a charge group on some other protein. And that, in turn, makes this protein catalytically active, because it was just waiting. It's an enzyme that was just waiting to be activated. And it activates another enzyme and another enzyme. So there is the signaling cascade that occurs. And eventually, this last enzyme activates, again by covalent modification, another protein, which this time is not an enzyme. It's a DNA binding protein or transcription factor. And once it is properly charged, it is translocated into the nucleus, and it binds DNA in some strategic location. So the strategic location is...
Is the charging necessary for it to bind, or is the charging necessary for it to go through the nuclear membrane?
I don't know. Possibly both.
Is there any obvious purpose to this multi-stage process? I mean, why wouldn't X just go to F?
That's a very good question that many people would like to understand. And the problem with this is there isn't just one answer. There are many answers. There are various ways in which you can interpret this. So for example, each of these stages can be used to amplify, right? Because this can activate many molecules, this can activate many molecules, et cetera, et cetera. You can build a switch out of this, because you know there are actually feedbacks. You can remember that this isn't the only signaling pathway in yeast cell. There are many. And you can imagine that there are other inputs that are being combined by the system. So, but this exactly illustrates the problem. We can understand how this works, but we will not understand why it is made this particular way, because another possible answer is that you know, the answer is because, right? Because you know, Papa yeast had this arrangement, and so it went for many generations before, right? It's tradition.
Can I ask you a question? I want to intentionally ask it in a non-scientific way. Who tells F star to go into the nucleus? Or is it that X star, Y star, they all try to get in the nucleus, but because of some biochemistry, they couldn't get into the nucleus, and only F star can get in? But everybody's trying to get into the nucleus? Well, who tells F star?
Well, it's actually not easy to get into the nucleus. Right. There are nuclear pores and transporters, and there are, you know, different proteins have sort of signals which allow it to be sort of translocated into the nucleus. And I actually don't know how it works with you know, ST12, which happens to be the protein that is doing the job in mating. And
so does X star try, or it doesn't even try to get it?
Well, it's there, so it's trying. But you know, one possibility would be that it has this nuclear translocation signal, which is a little domain on the protein, which is hidden in one conformation, in inactive conformation, but is exposed in. Okay.
I don't even understand Tony's question. I don't know what trying means. Is there a potential? Is there an attraction?
Not on this large scale. So everything is screened. But you know, things diffuse. So you know, it's trying diffusively, right? All right. So this transcription factor gets into the nucleus in one way or the other, and binds upstream of the mating genes. Binds DNA upstream of these genes, and so that there is this, if you like, a regulatory leader attached to each and every gene, and transcription factors of various sorts bind there, and their presence then helps to, you know, assembles complicated machinery which then transcribes the gene, which is to say makes a messenger RNA, which is then going to be turned into a protein. Okay, so mating. So, okay, fine. So there are many mating genes. Now we've activated these mating genes, and they will start growing protrusions called schmooze, and and the cells will start schmooing. Now I need some other color. Okay, how about filamentation? Oh, I should say one thing. How did the biologists discover this? By genetic means, basically by disrupting different steps in the cascade, by making mutants which lack this or that. And, okay. So now, how about filamentation? So it was discovered that poor nutrition of course is not detected by a receptor, but it turns out to still act by activating one of these early enzymes. And on the other hand, it was found that activation of filamentation genes also requires the same transcription factor as mating. So this would make for a very, very confused yeast. So something must be different.
Excuse me. Do you call transcription factor because it makes a copy of the gene?
Transcription of gene into RNA.
Ah,
so there are two steps. There are two steps on the way from gene to a protein. Transcription of DNA message into RNA message, and then RNA is then translated into amino acids. And
what is that is crossed between the two cells? The RNA crosses? What is the cross?
Ooh, well, so, you know, they basically merge. Right, so they eventually merge and form, you know, combine their chromosomes and...
Oh, they actually merge into one cell? And the nuclei also?
Well, this is, I was hoping to to avoid getting into this anatomy. It turns out that the yeast can exist in two states. Haploid have only one copy of each chromosome, and then they sort of happily divide or bud. Or diploid, where they combine the two chromosomes, and then they still continue dividing and budding, but in this diploid state. So here mating is just going from a haploid cell to a diploid cell. So I've got to erase this. Okay, so how do we start getting out of this terrible conundrum? Well, it turns out that the mating pathway involves an additional protein which forms a scaffold where these different enzymes bind, and that it really forms sort of a multi-molecular complex, sort of a charged cassette, which is ready to go when the signal is detected. And another difference is here. It turns out that mating is activated not by a single copy of this transcription factor, but by a homodimer. And filamentation is activated by a heterodimer, which is to say by a dimer made with some other transcription factor, which is called U here for ubiquitous, because that thing is just available in the cell. So these are the two differences. But still, you know, the bulk of the pathway is common. So there is somehow a lot of crosstalk in these two pathways. So that's the... the crosstalk problem. Well, Anta Nama Barkai. So Nama gave a very nice talk here. And Mr. et al., who the student of Nama, whose name I unfortunately forgot, proposed that the way the information from these two pathways is kept apart is by temporal coding. And the argument is very simple and goes as follows. So, what's the difference between the two pathways? There is the scaffold. So mating has it, and filamentation doesn't. That basically means that in the mating pathway, the signaling occurs locally, right there at the receptor. Whereas in a filamentation pathway, the signaling occurs in the soup, in the bulk. So it is reasonable to imagine, and Barkai and friends, I think, provide some estimates, that the rate of F star production in the mating pathway is fast. And in contrast, in the filamentation pathway, it is slow. So let's just write down. Well, I think we need to become quantitative at this stage, right? And we're going to write the one and only equation. So let's see what's happening to this activated transcription factor. Well, it is generated by this pathway, right? It is produced. And then it is taken up into the nucleus. And there are two processes which take them up. So the first order process where, it is bracket means concentration, where it meets up with U. And, maybe I'll just write it out explicitly, and goes in. And then the second order process, where it meets up with itself and goes in. So clearly, at very low concentrations of F star, this process is going to dominate over that. Right? Now, if you're producing, if you're signaling very slowly, right, this input is low, and you're just going to balance this production with the first order term. So most of the factor that you produce will be bound up into these heterodimers, right? On the other hand, if you crank this up, you will rapidly exceed the crossover point between the two processes, and you will start making dimers. So that's it. That's all there is to the story. So I'm sure that, I'm afraid that some of you are disappointed that, you know, that there are no path integrals here, anything like this. But in my view, this is actually a wonderful example of sort of phenomenological theory. There was a real conundrum, this crosstalk. And this model is so sufficiently informed on the molecular level, but on the other hand, it's really not trying to be anatomically correct. You know, we could have written down 57 equations here instead of just this. And it's precisely the simplicity which is giving it a fighting chance to be correct. And by all means, we really don't know whether it's correct or wrong, correct or not, right? But it is making falsifiable predictions, right? It is immediately telling us that by increasing the concentration of this ubiquitous competitor, or decreasing the concentration of the will shift in a predictable way the balance between filamentation and mating. Or if we manage to, somebody can manage to change the rate of signaling through the scaffold complex, again, there's a prediction for what should happen.
But in this example, to what extent is this an example of quantitative biology? Because as David Gross said, you don't even know, have to write down this equation, right? Just the picture already tells you that
if David saw through the answer,
you are observing filamentation happens to some extent all the time.
Isn't that some filamentation, even when you're not?
Just because there's mating going on, mating drives something.
Well, you know, I think the proponents, I think the proponents of this theory would say that you know, the signals that come through these two pathways are, you know, very, very different, if you like, in the time domain, which you know, I didn't quite describe here, right? That one is basically a fast, a large spike, whereas the other one is slow activation.
Of course,
a single F star won't bind on its own. Right, the signal F star will not bind on its own. And in fact, we have to go back to the translocation question. I don't even know whether it translocates on its own. So, and actually that makes a difference. Right. Okay, anyway, so.
Is it quantitative in the sense that you do experiments to measure how big K1 and K2 are?
One could. One could. But in a way, I'm almost trying to argue against it, against this, because there is sort of the background notion in the biology community that you know, modeling is impossible until we know everything about the system. And then from my point of view, since we'll never know everything about the system, it just means that modeling is impossible. So we basically have to look for, I think, some sort of phenomenological models where, you know, you can make falsifiable predictions and sort of sharpen the experimental questions and move on. If somebody measures these kinetic constants, well, that's great. Okay, let me.
Do you have both things of the same molecule, or is it a specific size that it binds? You have the FU and the FF.
So this is really just saying that the binding sites, right, upstream of these filamentation genes are different from binding sites upstream of mating genes, right? Because this binding is specific, which is to say, right, the blue things separate, recognize certain nucleotide subsequences. So you'll have these two blue things in DNA, and here you'll have a blue binding site in the DNA, and a purple binding site in the DNA. So there's really a sense in which the regulatory regions of these different type genes are different. Okay, I should.
Of course, for this to work, the temporal difference of the two signals is essential.
Yeah.
Now, what controls the mating signal? The nutrient signal, that's the environment. But how does
the mating signal is detection of the pheromone. So now we can start asking, how many receptors does it take to trigger mating? And that there is most certainly accommodation or adaptation, excuse me, adaptation that the effect will wear off rather rapidly upon sort of encountering the pheromone, etc., etc. So all these questions can be asked.
Being admitted all the time by the yeast, the other yeast.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, actually, I don't know the answer, whether it's only happy yeast which will produce pheromone or
pheromone comes, is emitted by some other
by yeast. By somebody else, yes.
Which might be a few centimeters away. Right? So how does that initiate mating with whom?
So, actually, there were some talks about that last week. So there is presumably some non-uniform distribution of the pheromone, and then they literally start growing these protrusions, schmooze, in the direction of the pheromone where it was detected. So they sort of get polarized. And the question, how many it takes, I don't know the answer.
How does... So there's some other... That alpha does something else locally to remember the spot location.
Oh, no, that's so the receptor. So then there's some...
How does it decide what direction?
So here was the receptor.
Right, more around the cell. Is that the point?
That receptor is...
Yeah, so the receptor is activated somehow, and along with this signaling, there are all sorts of other morphological changes that start accumulating in the cell. And anyway, they say it's not at all obvious whether this temporal coding is the right thing or wrong. But I think it's an interesting thought, and it's certainly going to stimulate some activity. Right. I'm going to brutally erase this before I get any more questions.
Surface tension is not an important effect in membrane.
By and large, you would say no, because there are a lot of active sort of actin polymerization processes going on, but you may think that it plays a role possibly in fact regulating actin polymerization, sort of giving sort of mechanical feedback back to the proteins. Okay, anyway, so I have to fast forward. And talk a little about the development, so that Lewis can get mad at me. Otherwise, the talk would not be complete. So, anyway, let's think about the development of a nice complex organism like a fly. So it starts developing from the embryo, goes through larval stages where it grows rapidly, and then sort of metamorphs into a fly. And actually it turns out that all of the adult organs and limbs develop as sort of sacs hidden in the body of the larva. So they're actually called, they look like discs, so they're called imaginal discs. And these organ precursors derive from local patches of cells in the embryo. And the fate of these embryonic cells, who is destined to become a leg and who is destined to become a wing, is sealed by a pattern of expression of certain selector genes, so that you know, different patches of the embryo express different subsets, or I'm sorry, different sets of these selected genes. And the question is, how is this spatial pattern of gene expression developed? And I should say that these selected genes actually code for, again, transcription factor proteins, which will mostly start acting a little later and will sort of generate the morphological and some functional changes that will actually differentiate the cell. So this spatial patterning starts in the embryo or the egg, where the mother very thoughtfully deposits a bit of messenger RNA at one of the poles. And that messenger RNA then is translated locally, which is to say the protein is manufactured locally, and then it spreads, perhaps diffusively, perhaps not, throughout the cell. So this protein is called a morphogen, and it sets up a gradient, or, well, really it sets up most likely, well, not most likely, it sets up an exponential profile with characteristic length, most likely given by diffusivity or some effective diffusivity, and the lifetime of this morphogen, because this protein is degraded in sort of actively degraded by proteases in the bulk of the embryo. So this morphogen is itself, again, a transcription factor. So it's going to get into a nuclei and start driving expression of downstream genes. Now, different genes, you can almost still see this picture, will have binding sites for the morphogen, and some of these binding sites will be weak, will have low affinity, so that those genes will be sensitive to only high concentrations of the morphogen, and will end up turning on only close to the pole. And then some other genes will have stronger binding sites, and will be activated by lower concentrations, and so let me call the blue one, I'll call it X, so this one will be Y. So in principle, it can now extend over this larger region. Now, if you imagine that it is inhibited by the first one, then its expression can be localized to a stripe.
Is this not a fact or just Wolfer's theory?
Just, please, hang on for a second. Hang on for a second.
Boris, you've already assumed something.
Please, just, I need you to hang on for 1 second. Well, so finally, okay, so you already see where I'm going. So perhaps there is a third one. I need red chalk. What's happening?
So, there be Z overlapping with X?
since they're both laid down at the same time.
Why would or would not?
You're saying Z so, is inhibited by X, but X and Z are being laid down at the same time.
Well, you know, then the pattern can refine itself.
Oh, it's because they're right. Being degraded all the time.
Right.
They need to be replaced.
Right. Right. So anyway, so here's a picture of how you can generate a spatial pattern of expression, and I just presented it as a fact. In fact, it's a theory proposed by Wolpert in 68. And at that time, we certainly didn't know what morphogen molecule was, and Lewis can start disagreeing with me. There was a very, very little molecular basis to make such a proposal, and it's really a triumph of theory, you know, triumph of pure thought that you know, since then, actually morphogen has been discovered, and we've learned all the details about you know, all the sort of molecular details, which allow us to think of why a given gene is activated in this region and not right. We can even be quantitative about affinities of these different binding sites. So this, of course, is called the French flag model.
Freedom.
I think by act of Congress, it got renamed last week. So. But in any case,
Is it freedom dressing?
No. Yes.
It's freedom fries, and it's
freedom fries and
chicken. Okay. Anyway. But so here is this morphogen-driven patterning mechanism, and the remarkable thing about it is that it is in a way universal. So. It's the first step in the patterning of activation of these selected genes, but then it turns out that if you look at what happens at the later stage, right, once this precursor of, say, the wing starts developing, well, it starts as little colony of 20 or 50 cells which express the right complement of transcription factors.
Excuse me, you drew a two-dimensional grid, presumably it's three-dimensional,
yes.
But you drew stripes.
It's actually two-dimensional, so maybe we should make something very general out of it, but the development largely seems to be two-dimensional. So.
Well, I could see how the white would be in the middle, but the blue would always be on the edges.
We
get positions in the grid from a picture of stripes.
Oh, whoa! I'm sorry. So then, of course, a similar process occurs along the other axis.
Oh, so several of these.
Yeah, absolutely. There are quite a few things that happen in between this and that.
This group that you draw is one molecule or many molecules?
So this it starts out as an egg. With just a single, not one molecule, but a single nucleus.
A single molecule.
And then the nucleus starts dividing, and the nuclei line up along the surface of this giant big bag, which is a peculiarity of fly development, that it develops, it cellularizes rather late. So it will first.
You have a distribution of nuclei. Some in the green. Green is not that. Some in the blue. Some in the white. Some in the red. And those are affected differently. So the genes.
Correct. So these nuclei express different genes already, right? And then cell walls will form. So at this stage, sort of late in the embryo. this is sort of an ellipsoid with cells on the surface, and then it starts invaginating and sort of folding and sort of developing a three-dimensional structure, basically by folding a two-dimensional surface.
But you have only one of these molecules that makes the difference.
There are more. All right. So again, this wing precursor has a line of cells which actually live on the boundary of one of these expression domains, and these cells secrete another morphogen, another molecule, which again spreads and forms this.
Is this just within that little pink region, or now you're looking perpendicular at the embryo?
I'm looking from the top on the pink region. And again, there appear to be several thresholds, and you know, some genes are expressed, driven by high levels of this morphogen, and other genes extend further into the tail. And then the boundaries of these domains end up related to the internal structure of the wing, these sort of veins in the wing which form its kind of a skeleton. So it's very reassuring that the idea is that drives the patterning is the same. So I have a little bit of time. But there is a lot more to understand.
Does this idea works for us also? Is this with the way in which...
Sorry, you are basically in this...
In the same way you fly.
That's the point. Any fly would say, gosh, aren't you similar to us?
But different from a worm. But different from a worm. Yes.
Since the cells in the different side, in the different parts of the wing come from different types of expression, are they different in any way? Can you? I mean, basically, the cells on the side, for example, they come from a less, from a lower concentration than the ones in the middle.
Well, see, the point here is that the progenitors of the wing is really a very small cluster of cells, so they're not that different. Then, of course, in reality, they are different because they happen to. So straddle the boundary, and it's precisely, so even there are so few of them, there is what's called anterior and posterior region. So it sort of starts with two domains, but it then has to generate more internal structure in addition to that. Okay, so there are many things we have to understand. So we have to, for example, understand not just how this pattern is laid out, but how the pattern manages to be nice and proportional and robust to all kinds of perturbations. So for example, you can you know, the flies that are hungry will grow smaller than the well-fed flies, but they're still perfectly proportionate and perfectly functional flies. Or you know, flies grown at low temperature will take longer to develop, but then will come out good. And this can be, you know, made even more striking by looking at the mutants. So for example, there are mutants which makes cells larger. So maybe I should introduce the scales right here. So there are several length scales that are involved. There's the size of the cell. There is the characteristic scale of the pattern, which is inherited from the morphogen. There's lambda. And there is the size of the tissue. And of course, along with patterning, we have growth, because this starts with 50 cells, but will grow to 50,000 cells. So what we want to understand is how patterning is coupled to growth, and how organisms manage to grow these perfectly proportionate organs. So mutants. You can have mutants with larger cells. And depending on the type of mutant, in let's say one case, these mutants will actually grow larger flies. So the number of cells stays constant, but the cell size has increased. The flies are larger, and they're still perfectly proportioned, which is to say that the pattern scale to the scale of the size of the fly is the same, right? And then there are other mutants which make cells bigger that actually don't change the size of the organ, because the number of cells has gone down so as to precisely compensate for the change in the size of the cell. So what is this mechanism of compensation, right? That's one of the mechanisms at work in keeping things nice and balanced. So let's think for a moment about growth. So until now I was talking about patterning. Let's think for a moment about growth. So you have these cells which divide, and the daughter cells divide, and they grow all more or less the same size and push each other out of the way. So, you know, if this division is uniform, you'll say that, you know, obviously the size of the tissue is going to be proportional to the cell size, and their number, which grows exponentially. So you expect the tissue to be larger if the cells get larger. But now suppose that the growth is not uniform, but perhaps depends on the concentration of that morphogen field, you know, in some fashion. So that's our morphogen again. So then we have to redo this estimate a little bit more carefully. So again, we actually have to write down an equation. So let's describe the growth of tissue in the continuum limit. So we'll say that there is some displacement, and there is a displacement field which is driven by the growth as a source, right? So, right, division is just introducing new tissue, and is generating a local dilation, right? And then the cells move out so as to make room for the new tissue, and you already observe that in this continuum limit, the funny thing happened. The cell size has dropped out, right? This is just a rate. dimensional analysis, no cell size. So you're not then surprised to find that if you estimate the size of the tissue after a little while, it's going to be proportional not to a cell size, but to the pattern scale, right? And this simply happened, right? So intuitively, this is happening because, right, if you have larger cells, they're going to move out of the zone of growth faster and divide fewer times. And that's going to be a perfect compensation mechanism, just the continuum limit. And this has this makes it immediate predictions. This is basically saying that the cell size dependence somehow has to enter indirectly, perhaps through this. And you would interpret the mutants in a very simple way. We'll say that this mutant of type 1, the morphogen scale has not changed. Whereas in mutant type 2, the morphogen scale did change. And then you can, push this along a little bit. And so clearly you have a simple, again, phenomenological model. There is very little molecular detail, or no molecular detail, that went into this. But you're making falsifiable predictions. And Lewis doesn't believe a word of it, so I'm very disappointed that he's so quiet. So, because, I wanted the... I don't really want it. So anyway, it's...
some of those physical mechanisms that you said, like temperature or whatever, wouldn't you expect them to change lambda? Or have the effect of mutant type 2?
Possibly. And so we have to worry about, do cold flies actually grow exactly the same size? And they probably don't. Right. But there's certainly size variation, right? That size is not controlled in centimeters, right? So there is probably there are internal checkpoints, but these internal checkpoints act on the level of the proportion. They control the ratio of lambda to L. And you're entitled to ask what determines that ratio. And it's a little bit hidden here. And if I continue along in that direction, Lewis is really going to kill me. So I'm not, because I'm running out of time. And
but again, you describe this as a phenomenological approach, and you say it's verifiable or falsifiable.
Right.
I mean, presumably, in the way you've described it, I could write down maybe several different simple differential equations which had the same general behavior, but were quantitatively different. And is that what's done to make this quantitative comparison? Or, I mean, suppose it went as e to the minus t, e to the g naught t squared, or, some function of temperature. How would you know it's any different?
Right. So I think that what we want to compare is the falsifiable predictions are a little bit different nature. Once you know that the difference between these mutants resides in the scale of a morphogen, you have to think, what is the physical mechanism that sets the scale of a morphogen? And very roughly, again, it's going to be the effective diffusivity of the morphogen and some rate of degradation. And it is believed that the degradation of the morphogen is due to uptake of the morphogen by the cells. So it is proportional to concentration of receptors, right? And then what you expect is the following, that in mutant type 1, the density of receptors on the surface is unchanged. But in mutant type 2, it is changed. And so very naively, if mutant type 2, it's the number of receptor molecules per cell that is actually conserved, right? Then the receptor density is going to go down as 1 over the area squared, and you'll end up with right, lambda proportional to the cell size, but for sort of a very peculiar reason. And in reality, probably the number of receptors is not completely conserved, but you know, probably just decrease. So right, and this proportionality is not exact proportionality, and then we have to go back to these mutants and actually look at so more precisely whether they scale with the size or a little bit slower than that or what. Okay, anyway.
This hasn't yet been tested. Make a quick comment.
Yes?
The reason why there's a thing is that I don't believe that the morphogen actually specifies either the size or the positional identity. There's an unknown mechanism by which cells acquire a positional identity. But of course, to do it by morphogen would be totally unreliable. You'd never get the positions that you actually need.
So Lewis has a different hypothesis, but luckily we don't really have to argue about it. All we need to do is, I know, all the fun is in arguing. We can just make falsifiable predictions and test it. So anyway.
This has been done. Namely, there have been well-defined falsifiable predictions that have falsified.
Well, so I have collaborators. I have. I have two experimental collaborators at EMBL in Germany, Aurelia Telemann and Steve Cohen, who are actually undertaking some further experimentation along these lines. So, we'll know.
I asked was whether. You
know, this, there is a tradition that,
you know, have there been interesting model ideas that have been false?
French flag is falsified?
No, it's not falsified.
I falsified theory through it. George Oster, even George Oster admitted that I falsified one of his predictions.
Well,
or George, that's quite, you know, George.
No, I think it's more important whether there have been you know, so theoretical proposals that have not been falsified, and you know, French flag is I think, an excellent example. I think the problem is not with falsifying; the problem is in convincing anybody to falsify. So that's why you see you know, the theorists trying to set up their labs. But anyway. I'm not going to have any time to talk about evolution of networks, but I'll just conclude again by reiterating that I'm sort of advocating a middle ground between the two extremes. So one extreme, you know, there are people in bioinformatics who view modeling as a form of data compression. So once we'll know everything about the system, we're going to have a database with all this information, and we're going to have a Java applet which will execute will solve kinetic equations, and we'll be able to produce for pharmaceutical companies predictions of the effect of drug X on signaling pathway Y. The other extreme is David tells me that Albert Lipchaber gave a talk at the APS, 2 weeks ago, basically saying that in order to understand biology, we need theory and new mathematics. So I think in between.
What do you mean new mathematics?
Like, no, please ask Albert.
What are you like for? It's like a new science.
You're giving the continuum.
So,
what kind of new mathematics is
the other? I think what he meant was that mathematics as a tool in science develops in response to specific problems. And biology might call it mathematics. It's very vague. But he also, he expressed the belief that there would be one, new mathematics required, and two, that behind some of the issues in biology, the deep issues, there is some beautiful.
Well, that may well be, but in a
religious faith.
Sounds very religious to me.
Okay. In the meantime, I think that there is plenty of room for kind of phenomenological modeling that physicists are very, very familiar with.
Can you remind?
And thank you very much.
Well, I think we have time for
more. Yeah. Can you elaborate on your somewhat derogatory remark about beta compression? In a sense, you can say any theory is data compression, right? Newton's theory, Einstein's theory, general relativity is data compression.
I'm not against data compression. This is perfectly fine, sort of information theorist's view of theory. The question is whether it is possible to model before we know everything, whether theory can have somewhat more active role in the development of the biology.
You mean and in theoretical physics?
Precisely. And of course, it always had, in the sense that every paper, every biology paper starts with a little bit of theory. It's called a hypothesis. And then it proceeds to verify the hypothesis, because if it's falsified, it wouldn't be in the paper, right? So what's not there is the separation of labor between the theory and an experiment that we have in physics, where you can write a theoretical paper, and if it's interesting enough, right? So you throw it out into the world, and if it's interesting enough, somebody will Albert Lipchaber will be interested in proving you wrong, right? So somebody will pick it up. It's not at all obvious that it can happen in biology, but I'm optimistic because.
Why? What's in the history of the culture of the subject that makes it different in this way from?
Because the models, these hypotheses. Have by and large been very, very simple. So they're little cartoons, and a lot of experiments are binary in nature. So an experiment will ask, is the protein X important in process Y, right? And the answer is yes, no. And then you accumulate knowledge by making this many sort of binary bisections, right? Which is very different from what we do in physics, where we make analog predictions, right? That you have to be measured with precision, et cetera, et cetera. And then the theory and the modeling has to be much more quantitative, mathematical, et cetera. So I think there will be more of that in biology in future.
I must defend theoretical biology since I'm the editor of the journal. and to point out that there are whole areas of biology which are very mathematical. for the man with quantitative genetics and population bias?
It's just statistics.
Sorry?
It's just statistics.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm sorry,
again,
it's not my area, but
when you say it's just statistics,
that's how
hard to do it.
I'm sorry, I'm not a quantitative
biologist. But Louis, what about
neuroscience and auction, how to say equations?
Well, that,
those are
the trial of theory in biology of the Hodgkin-Huxley.
That's an example.
But,
remember,
the cells are basically complicated chemistry.
And so you shouldn't be surprised that one can apply mathematics to many of the processes. I mean, in zymokinetics, I mean, the people who work on metabolic networks, for example, there's all sorts of theory involved in many, many aspects. And in ecology, and what, I mean, if you said this to Lord May, our president, so, I mean, he'd be absolutely crazy. They apply a lot, and these people apply mathematics all the time.
The question is the same one doing the experiments, the testing.
Well, I think they are. I think that my particular subject, in cell developmental biology, the experimenters have not been terribly interested in it. And partly because it hasn't given them very much to do. You see, an enormous number of papers were written, for example, on the Turing, on reaction diffusion equations. I don't know a single example in the whole of biology where they really work. Gira Meinhardt a little bit.
Were they published in theoretical biology?
It's a problem. I think you should. But there is a tradition that, for example, there's not. If you ask how many departments of theoretical biology are there in the world, 3, 4, 5, 6, very, very, very small. And if you're a theoretical biologist, it ain't easy to get a job. I think things are improving.
You made the remark that theoretical biologists are setting up laboratories to test their hypotheses.
We're on the same side here.
You would agree.
Yeah.
Theoretical biology, on the whole, does not have a good name among experimenters.
Right.
Because failures hasn't given them enough, or that they haven't been very successful. They feel they haven't had it.
But I think there is hope. There is hope to change that in the future.
Yes, of course. And I think I don't know a research council anywhere in the world that isn't investing in this area at the moment. It's a hot topic.
Just one question. When theorists produce some ideas, they have to be testable. Do biologists offer models like with this K1 and K2 and this and that and the other that can be measured and therefore they are in agreement with experimentalists? It's not only that there will be people willing to do the experiment, but that they can be measured.
Absolutely. Well,
do you produce models that can be tested with testable?
Well, so that's the whole point. So you want the kind of modeling which is both informed by the experiment and can speak back to the experiment, right?
And insight.
I mean, precisely.
Guidance.
I think we're
okay. Let's thank Boris.
Thanks a lot.